The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for June 9th, 2016, the textbook definition of racism edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson is back with me in Washington, D.C. of Face the Nation. Hello, John. You were gone last week.
I was gone. It was my colleague said, you know, you should tell Emily and David where you are, because they said on the Gabfest they didn't know where you were as we were walking to go interview Donald Trump. So I was like, well, I'll let them know. But now I'm letting you know I was in Los Angeles last week.
Interviewing Donald Trump?
Yeah. While I was flying there while you guys were recording.
And we're going to talk about that interview, I hope.
We sure will. We have to just, I'm not sure this is going to come up in the interview, but John had the one line in there. It was so quick response when Trump said Clinton was guilty of being stupid. John, like Steph Curry taking a three, said if that being stupid were a crime, we'd all be in jail. That was, is that like a thing that someone has said to you, or you just came up with that?
It's the first song on my folk album. It's just something I deeply believe, being a person who does stupid things regularly.
It's true. In fact, then I saw Orrin Hatch said something about how, I've done unbelievably stupid things in my life, talking about some stupid thing Trump had said. We all say stupid things and do stupid things. That other voice, of course, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, joining us from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, guys.
On this week's Gabfest, will Donald Trump's racist assault on a federal judge cause him lasting damage? It sure should, but will it? Then Hillary Clinton clinches the Democratic nomination. When and how will Bernie Sanders reconcile himself to that fact? Then the case of Brock Turner, the Stanford rapist whose lenient sentence has outraged just about everyone. Will it outrage us? Probably. It will. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, the anti-Semites and the parentheses, we will try to make sense of the punctuation war that has gripped the internet, or Twitter, or parts of the internet. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. And don't forget, July 13th, that is just a month away, at 7 p.m., we will have a live show in Washington, D.C. It's our first live show in D.C. for a year. It's going to be at the Warner Theater in downtown Washington. If you can get tickets at slate.com/live. July 13th, 7 p.m., slate.com/live for tickets. We really hope to see you there. Donald Trump this week took a snail's pace backward from the vile racist attack he has made against Judge Curiel. Am I pronouncing that right? Curiel? The federal judge overseeing a suit against Trump's appalling Trump University. Trump said his remarks about Curiel had been misconstrued, which is pretty funny. Like, he clearly was trying to construe them. The idea that they're being misconstrued was ridiculous, but he did slightly retreat from them. But he had spewed repeated hateful comments about Curiel, saying that he was a Mexican, which Curiel is not, and that the fact that he was a Mexican made him biased and unfit to judge Trump. Hilariously unfit to judge Trump because Trump says vile things about Mexicans, and therefore no one should be able to judge him for that. I don't know.
No, actually, he said it's because of the wall.
Yeah, because I propose to do vile things towards Mexicans. Well, what about the Muslims? Trump raised and re-raised and eventually told John here that a Muslim judge might also be unfit to judge him because of bias, possibly. There was almost universal condemnation about what Trump said, not least from Republicans. Let us talk about that condemnation. Let's also talk about the kind of whether this has a long-term cost for Trump. So Paul Ryan said of Trump's comments, this is the textbook definition of racism. Why, Emily, is there so much outrage on the right about this attack on a judge?
Well, for one thing, Trump was assuming that Judge Curiel's heritage defined his views in a way that precluded him from being fair as a judge. And conservatives, and this isn't only conservatives, but conservatives care a great deal about the independent judiciary and also don't normally argue that people's racial and ethnic identity determine everything about them. They tend to think in more fluid terms about race and ethnicity and other forms of identity and imagine that people can empathize and can think about other people's points of view. I mean, I think it was deeply unsettling about Trump's whole framing is this idea that any judge can't set aside his or her feelings about some unrelated matter. I mean, this was all such conjecture, right? There was no actual statement from this judge that he was in any way influenced by Trump's crazy wall building plans. And then the other thing, and this, I suppose, isn't a conservative objection, it's mine, though, is that Trump's idea of his sort of definition of fairness, once he's crossed out people of Mexican heritage and Muslim, seems to be reverting to this white male judge as the norm that everyone else is deviating from. And that's just wrong and a problem in itself.
I wonder if Trump, did you ask him, John, if Trump thinks that a black defendant accused of a crime against a white person should have a black judge, deserves, is entitled to a black judge?
I didn't ask that because we were, you know, we spent a lot of time on the specifics of this case. It was basically what he was trying to say is the rulings have been so against me. This is the only thing I can think of that would explain why he's been, this particular judge has been so against me. But he never really said it that succinctly. And that doesn't explain his view about the Muslim judge, because there is no Muslim judge who has had rulings to, which is why that distinction is more than just.
That's a good point, right?
So that.
Yeah, that's totally a good point. That's all theoretical, right? That's like, oh, this person would not be able to be fair to me, not has not been fair.
So I interviewed Paul Ryan on Tuesday. I'm losing track of the days here. Just in terms of what you were talking about, Emily, and the kind of bedrock belief of conservatives. I mean, he went when I said, so why is this? Because the word racist gets thrown around obviously a lot, and then there is and conservatives feel like it gets overused in every little way. And so when Paul Ryan says this statement is a textbook definition of racism, so what did that mean to him? He went back to the founding of the Republican Party, Ripon, Wisconsin, and he said, we're a party that was founded by abolitionists. And in fact, he was that day doing an event to unveil a new poverty agenda for the House. And in the poverty agenda announcement that was before my interview, he said, the condition of your birth does not determine the outcome of your life. He was, in another context, stating as a truth something that is at issue here with what basically Donald Trump was claiming, which is that the condition of his birth, which is that he has Mexican parents, determined the outcome of his rulings.
It's almost impossible to talk about this. I find this so hard to talk about. It's such a strange hill for Trump to fight on. There's no reason for him to.
He put himself there.
Yeah, it's
right?
Not an issue that he needed to raise. It doesn't help him politically at all. It's insulted every person it could insult and infuriated his party, it doesn't even help him in the particulars of his attempt to influence the judge to improve his case.
I think a lot of this comes from, it's his argument. I think what we're seeing here basically, by the way, is the shift from the primary to the general, because he's mentioned this before, the heritage of the judge, but it was mentioned in the primary context in which this kind of kerfuffle wouldn't happen. But I think what his argument to me was, we have to stop being so politically correct. If a thing is a thing and I see it that way, I'm just going to say it. I'm not going to like dance around it. And for him, that is a central truth. And for a lot of his supporters, that's a central truth. And so his starting point on a lot of these things is like, this is the way I see it. I'm going to say that's the way I see it. It seems to have worked pretty well for me so far, and I'm going to keep going. And then so the fact that it hasn't worked well for him in this instance, this is why this is going to be a constant battle back and forth for the next 6 months. And he's going to have to be battling basically Paul Ryan a lot, I would think, on these things.
I also felt like watching this, there was a way in which I just didn't believe that he cares that much about becoming president. He seems obsessed with this litigation against him. And there is a tactical reason to make this argument, which is to try to force some kind of retrial or a motion later that this judge should have recused himself. But by fomenting all this discord and making these claims of bias, you can then say you've poisoned the well and the judge, in fact, is biased. And the idea that Trump would put winning this case and his indignation about the litigation ahead of his political future, it just seems telling to me, even though I totally agree this isn't calculated and he's been doing, right. His decision to say this as a way of continuing his appeal to his supporters, I get that, but I still feel like this is really strange.
Well, also not just ahead of the presidency, but ahead of actually important ideas about the independent judiciary, which the president needs to acknowledge and know about and enforce. And the fact that he is so obsessed with this case against him, he is willing to throw out wholesale critical aspects of the American experience and the American Constitution is super disturbing. Not just telling, it's like he only acts on instinct. He can't, there's no calm, rational person in there at all, apparently, because any calm, rational person would say, this is a stupid fight to have.
That's what terrifies the Republicans I've talked to, because what they see is it's not, let's forget for a moment the underlying facts of the case. And I don't mean the legal case, I mean the facts of the last week. What they see is unpredictability, going hard on momentary instinct without an instinct to climb down. And this has happened both now in public this week where people have said, stop it, stop it, stop it, and then other people privately. And that's what has Republicans so worried, because they've all hitched their wagon to this. I mean, I think somebody who's very supportive of Paul Ryan, who I was talking about this, was like, how is this tenable for him to, on the one hand, say, this is the textbook definition of racism, which is now about the fourth time he's had to rebuke Trump. How can he hold that opinion on the one hand, and then on the other hand say, he should be elected?
Right.
This is a person who is in Paul Ryan's corner. They think there's, you know, those two things you can't hold those two magnets together. They will flip apart. I'm not quite sure how that gets worked out either.
Do you think Trump has ever apologized for anything in his life? Do you think he's ever, you know, he like left the toilet seat up. He failed to drop Barron off at school that day and when he was supposed to. Do you think he has ever literally said, I'm sorry? He seems like somebody who I have somebody who I know very well who literally cannot say, I'm sorry, I did this. And it's a pathology. And I think Trump is like that. And he could get so far if he just like would. He clearly doesn't believe he should ever apologize for anything or back off of anything.
It's a good question. I can't think of an example, but I think your point is, so the two things it's almost impossible for politicians to say is, I'm sorry and I made a mistake. I mean, look at how much trouble Hillary Clinton has had with saying that about her server. But your point, I think, is the really smart one, which is that there are still so many people in his own party who are desperate for him to do anything. It would be overly applauded if he did just some small act of contrition or self-deprecation or anything like that. I mean, you look at the responses to his mere use of a teleprompter, right, which, by the way, I mean, this is, of course, what infuriates people about politics in general, which is that the momentary swamps the past. And so on the right, they get furious that anybody would want to talk about what Hillary Clinton believes today and not spend time dwelling on her past. And then on the left, they look at Donald Trump and they say, wait a minute, all he did was use a teleprompter. How is that, you know, how does that cover up, make better, even out all these other things? You know, there are a lot of people ready to say, oh, see, look, he's turned the corner. He's whatever, more presidential. And so what you're saying, your act of contrition would probably be received with that same kind of applause.
I mean, I kind of feel like so on Tuesday night when he was declaring victory and he'd won various primaries, he used a teleprompter and gave a speech that wasn't crazy. And people are saying, oh, that the Republicans are saying, look, now he's taken a lesson. It's the campaign has changed. It did. There's some bad analogy here, but it felt like almost like the Republicans have been so brutalized and so burned by him that any small, tiny thing like, oh, look, you know, they it's almost like an abused spouse who the husband brings flowers one day after, you know, having just beaten his wife up for the last 16 days. And the fact of bringing flowers that day is like, oh, OK, it's all changed. It's not all changed, guys. It's not going to that's probably a terrible analogy, but
I don't care whether he apologizes or not. I feel like he's dug himself in way too deep to get out of this with an apology, and it would be completely meaningless and unconvincing.
David's not making a case for he's making a case for showmanship and symbolism, not like whether it emphatically will change people's minds.
Yeah, but I think even on that level, it's meaningless at this point. And was pretty quickly.
But Emily, here's a question. There's a basically infinite list of grotesque statements that Donald Trump has made that are anathema to American values and ideals and decency, most of which he's made in the last year, many of which he's made in the last year. It's seriously an infinite number. Why should this one be the one that somehow sticks? Or is there any reason to think that this one is going to be the one that sticks?
Well, first of all, the timing, as John was saying, he's under a greater degree of scrutiny. The role the country is assessing him for is different. The moments of like, oh, this is entertaining and an extension of his reality TV persona, those are over. And then I think also there's a way in which this, he said so many racist things before. I can't say that this offends American values in a different way. Maybe it's just the timing and the way in which the timing forced conservatives and Republicans to respond and join in denouncing him instead of just trying to ignore him.
I also think this is different than things he said before. I mean, I think this is also it gets at a bedrock American, and as we started out by saying, it challenges an American ideal in a way that just felt direct.
Well, he said, I want to ban Muslims from immigration. That's pretty anathema.
Pretty un-American.
Right. I'm not defending that as a core American principle, but I guess this is, if there's a target, this is right in the bullseye, not like one ring out.
So last question on this, John, for you. Is there any point at which the heart of the Republican establishment, which is now more or less hitched itself to Trump, unhitches? Mark Kirk, a Republican running for Senate in Illinois, rescinded his endorsement, but Kirk is in a desperate state and you know, he's in a state where Trump's going to lose by 30 points and he's just doing what he has to do. Is the people who, the Paul Ryans, the Mitch McConnells, is there a point at which they decouple?
Two things keep them from doing that. One is Hillary Clinton. They really don't want her to be president. And so they would essentially be accepting that if they were to unendorse, because it would be a cataclysmic event if a leader unendorsed Trump. They would be blamed by a not insignificant portion of their voters for essentially doing what's electing Hillary Clinton. And also because a lot of people do see this as a politically correct witch hunt. They wouldn't think, oh, well, this is valid for them to back off. But the other thing they would have to weigh is Paul Ryan is basically saying, I have a set of ideas, and those ideas are more likely to get signed by President Trump than President Clinton. And since I believe in those ideas, this is the rationale he made when I asked him about it after he just said it was a textbook racist comment. So I still believe in those ideas. The problem or the challenge for him is, what if those ideas then start getting harmed by their association with Donald Trump or association with the party? I mean, there's an argument that this historian Bruce Miroff makes, which is a really compelling and interesting argument about in 72 when McGovern loses because he picks Thomas Eagleton and it just essentially destroys his campaign, that basically destroyed a set of liberal ideas because the ideas that were at the heart of McGovern's campaign couldn't get decoupled from his political incompetence. And so therefore, a bunch of ideas, when McGovern lost, people thought, oh, see, nobody can run as a real liberal, so don't try that again. So if the ideas get tied to Trump, then that's what you could imagine Ryan thinking, these things I really do care about are now in danger of getting destroyed.
I can't honestly believe that Republicans think in their heart of hearts that Donald Trump is a better president for America, or that they're more likely to have a better America after a Trump presidency than with a Clinton presidency. They can't possibly – with a Clinton presidency, that you can be a loyal opposition. You can continue to push forward your ideals. With a Trump presidency, like, insane things could happen.
I think it's a jump ball. I think based on the conversations I've had with people in the leadership in Congress, for sure, privately, I think that they are pretty close to what you just said. And then I think there's another group of people who think, like, they don't know what to do.
Right. So it really is pick your poison for them. I mean, that's a true feeling.
Okay. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th. Only on Hulu. Hillary Clinton clinched the Democratic nomination on either Monday or Tuesday of this week, depending on whom you believe. Certainly on Tuesday, she had a triumphant triumphant night. She strongly won the New Jersey and California primaries and a couple others. She locked in a majority of pledged delegates to accompany the supermajority of superdelegates that she had already won endorsement from. Let's not lose sight of the fact this is a historic moment. This is the first woman to win a major party presidential nomination in American history. That's fantastic.
Exciting. My heart fluttered.
Emily's heart fluttered. Don't have a heart attack. Don't have any heart condition.
No, it was a happy heart flutter. It was just a feeling of, I can't really believe this is happening. It was exciting.
The week has not been so historic for Bernie Sanders, who has neither dropped out of the race nor really acknowledged Clinton's triumph, nor even said anything particularly nice about her. So, Emily, Clinton on Tuesday night made very warm and gracious and welcoming remarks to Sanders and his supporters and praise, full of praise. How and when is he going to reconcile himself?
Soon and with great enthusiasm, but not quite yet. I love the story that Howard Dean keeps telling. I feel like I've read it now 10 times, that when he was at this moment in his campaign in, was that 2004, Al Gore called him on the phone, and Dean just says about himself that he just like ranted for 10 minutes about how he'd been cheated and done in, and it was such a terrible system. And Gore finally just said to him, this isn't about you, it's about the country. And then Dean pulled out of the race the next day. I mean, that's the point we're at. We're at the point of like reconciling oneself with disappointment and reality. And it makes sense that it takes at least a few days to process all of that. And Sanders, if he pulls out now and does it in an honorable, admirable way, he's going to leave this race a hero and with so much more power and clout than he had before. So I feel like it's I know he lost, but I really feel like it's just time for him to move the goalposts and declare a different kind of victory.
John, everyone's analogizing to Hillary Clinton in 2008 also, where she, you know, it was clear she was not going to be the nominee. She took a day and then she sort of came back and endorsed and campaigned and sort of supported Obama mm-hmm. in a helpful way. Sanders is not a Democratic Party loyalist. He barely is in the Democratic Party. The voters who are voting for him are distinctly not people who are hardcore Democratic voters.
Yeah, and to the extent they are Democrats, they're disappointed with the Democratic Party for not going far enough.
So is there any chance that this is a different situation? Hillary Clinton in 2008 was very tied in and sort of like had locked herself to the Democratic establishment. Sanders doesn't have that loyalty or necessity, right. And he's an old man.
And he's not trying to preserve his political viability for a future race. You know, Hillary Clinton had 2016 in mind in some fashion. So, I mean, I think you have two things that are going on with Bernie Sanders from his standpoint, I think. Although I've spent more time talking to the Republican side of the world this week. You have the heady fact that he did more and did better than anybody could have guessed, including himself. So that's just how to give that up is one thing. But then it's also how to not fritter that away. How, you know, you've got like this little snowball that you've kept alive in the heat of July and you want to do something with it. And then I think secondly, there's always been a feeling among liberals that he wants to keep alive the idea that even though everybody tells you it can't happen, you're wrong, the establishment is too big to fight, that they got much further and got pretty close to beating the establishment. And even if he never continues, which he won't, as a presidential candidate, you want to save that starter yeast. And this is one of the things that happened with Howard Dean is he was like, you know, that amazing sense of the system working. You want to keep that alive somehow. And so how is the best way to do that? The problem with the best way to do that is there isn't really – none of the things he will be given keep that idea alive really because the establishment won on the Democratic side, because the Democratic side isn't like the Republican side. There is no – I mean there are people who have very strong feelings who don't like the establishment, but they are not the Tea Party yet. There are not a host of Democrats who are worried about their jobs who might get voted out. There's no, the last, you know, when we saw Joe Lieberman lose in the Democratic primary when he was a senator, that was like the high watermark for non-presidential movements on the left. You know, there's not a movement across the country to throw out capitulating Democratic senators. There just isn't that movement.
Wait, but does that argue for Sanders graciously reconciling himself, or for Sanders being like, done, I'm out of here, and I'm not going to tell my voters what to do. I'm going to just sort of wish for a progressive revolution to continue.
I think it, I don't know. I don't know what's in his head. I think in the end, because he lost California by 13 points, because he is way under in the popular vote and way under in pledged delegates, and he doesn't have any support from Elizabeth Warren. He doesn't have any support. When Ted Kennedy did this in 1980, he had Democratic senators, Pat Moynihan, Robert Byrd, saying, the party really isn't the Carter, the party of Carter. It's the party of Ted Kennedy. But Hillary Clinton has lots of lots and lots of support in the Democratic Party. Like it's a true thing, not just in the votes that she got in all kinds of different ways, but in the polling. So it's harder for him to find fertile ground for that. And I think in the end, that will bring him into the fold to do the right thing by Democrats, which will be. And oh, by the way, two other things. He cares about issues, which he's going to have a chance to have some influence on. And B, I think, you know, Donald Trump as the alternative is a strong motivator.
Emily, if you're Hillary Clinton, you know, you're losing young voters 4-1, 5-1, 7-1 in some places to Sanders. What is it beyond getting Bernie Sanders to endorse you, which is, I think I agree with you guys, he will. What is it that you, Hillary Clinton, need to do to get these people to vote, enthusiastically come out, canvass for you, et cetera?
You present yourself as a really strong alternative to Trump. You know, you remind them that if they don't vote for you, they're going to be in some way, shape, or form helping to elect him, or certainly not standing in his way. And then you think deeply about whether your vice presidential choice should tilt in the direction of the left as opposed to the middle. I mean, without the Sanders candidacy, I feel like there's no question that Hillary would choose a vice president who would be designed to pick up independent voters, some of these white men who also are so uninspired by her.
Vice President white guy. Wait, but the independent voters is a weird, because the Sanders voters are independent voters too.
True. I guess I meant moderates. The middle, that elusive middle, whether it actually exists. Well, that's the thing. I mean, what do you think, John? Maybe that's not the smart play. Maybe she should.
The vice presidential thing always really irritates me, because I think the power of the vice presidential pick is tiny. I don't think it matters. I think it's a useful way to talk about the weaknesses of the underlying candidates. I think it can matter if you pick a bad choice. I mean, I think John McCain totally undermined his candidacy by picking Sarah Palin, because his candidacy was based on the idea that I'm ready from day one to do this job, and this guy has no skills. So then he picked a vice president who had none of the skills that he said were responsible for or necessary in the job, and then argued that she did. As a political move, we know why he picked Sarah Palin and why it was, you know, he needed to spur the party, and it did. So they can undermine you, but I don't think they can really like super boost you. And I scratch my head at the pushing of Elizabeth Warren for her. You know, when you talked about your reaction to Hillary Clinton as the first woman nominee, there are a lot of Democrats who are going to have that reaction, who recognize lots of her flaws and yet nevertheless had that gut level emotional reaction. And that won't go away. And I think also she, because we're now in a choice election, and I think she, remember how much people didn't know what her message was in the primaries, but now in her speech Tuesday night, she said, "We want to build bridges, not walls." That's a pretty good encapsulation of her entire message. She now has a message, which is in opposition to Donald Trump. And when people like Bob Corker were defending Trump, they were saying, "I'm not going to defend this behavior against a standard." One of the things we're going to flip back and forth between is how to judge these candidates against a fixed standard or against each other. And Bob Corker said, "I'm not going to defend the behavior, but we face a binary choice." In other words, this is a choice between two people, which helps him say, you know, in the end, I think Donald Trump would be better. But it also lets Hillary Clinton off the hook, because Clinton would very much like this election to be a choice, because then you're not judging her against the rules she broke on the email server. You're judging her against another person. Now, of course, she'd like it to be a referendum on Donald Trump. But I guess my point is on the left and the needs of the left, I think there will be a rallying behind her, the same way there was a rallying behind Trump. And your reaction felt like when you said that, I thought, well, there we are. We're seeing that's the rallying.
How many elections have we had where there's been this bridge metaphor? Bill Clinton was bridging yeah. the 21st century. There was the bridge to nowhere, the Sarah Palin bridge, the cheat
fall. Obama was kind of all about bridges.
People love the bridge metaphor.
People love
always
the bridge.
Want and yet America's bridges are in terrible shape. The infrastructure of America is falling apart. So people want
real
to
bridges.
This is a kind of a metaphor, which is people want to build bridges and you build a new bridge and it's great, but nobody wants to actually maintain the old bridge. And the old bridges are falling apart and crumbling and dangerous as hell. There's something
also,
profound here.
Yeah.
I'm giving this to somebody out there. There's a story for you.
Or just to comment on the gap. Fest,
why is the bridge always to the future? Why can't a bridge be to the past?
Yeah.
Why is
also
it
true?
Why is this always this? Is this a total triumph?
Donald Trump
of,
is building bridges to the past.
Right.
He just doesn't put
is
it
this
in
a,
that.
Is this a total triumph of Clinton's bridge to the 21st century? Like that we now think of bridges as being into the future? Because what if it's like a single lane bridge that no cars allowed?
Yeah. Or covered like a little a covered bridge.
Sure. Yeah. Bridges beautiful. Of Madison
Horse
County.
And buggies are only allowed to drive down it.
So I don't know what the smart pick is on the vice president, but can somebody make the super
you
smart
have a bridge
case
to sell us?
Yeah, super smart case for Elizabeth Warren as the like great slam dunk pick for Hillary Clinton.
I do not see it.
I'll make a case. She's excellent at taking on Donald Trump. She gets precisely the voters fired up that Clinton needs, not just to like be, you know, reconciled to her, but be knocking on doors for her. Clinton has weaknesses among younger women and married women. Warren could help. She, you know, would just get everyone super fired up because she's more exciting on the stump. And then this is a problem. She could also upstage Clinton, but she has much more of like a firebrand way about her that is very of this moment.
All right. So I think the problems with Warren are one, apparently, she's very difficult to work with and people don't like working with her. I think doubling down on old white women seems like a huge mistake. It just makes you the old white woman.
Oh, yeah. We've doubled down on old white men.
And it's and it's now it would be very hard. If Trump picks an old white guy, that's going to be a bad look for him, too. And people will beat him for it. I think Clinton
don't
has
think we're
to.
We're done with the two
Clinton has
old white guy ticket.
No.
Yeah, but we're done with not being a problem for candidates.
Yeah, and also I think we're done with the two old white guy ticket. I think you might have two young. I think there'll probably be two youngish white guys or the young old. It's going to be hard to have a two old white guys in the future. You don't think that, Emily?
It's irritating to decide that Warren can't be the vice president because she's a woman in her whatever it is, 50s or 60s. Like, I just, yes, I see that there's, she resembles Hillary Clinton in that way. But given all of our history, come on. I mean, that can't be the thing that disqualifies her. Come up with something.
But wait, why do you say come on? You mean because you wouldn't like it to be that way or because you don't think it really is that way?
I certainly don't like the idea that it's that way. And I'm not sure that it is that way. I mean, I think you could make an argument that Clinton needs women to come to her in droves with more of the, gender breakdown than Obama got with Romney. She is going to have, I mean, if you're scared of Trump, if you see his appeal as being with men,
why would women
men,
base their votes solely on the gender of the people being elected?
Not solely, but younger women have been super enthusiastic about Elizabeth Warren in particular. They see her as a standard bearer.
Up for issues or gender?
On issues. I mean, the things can get tangled up in each other, but on issues. I mean, there are younger women for whom Clinton feels like not the standard bearer they were looking for. I don't share this feeling, but you read it all the time. It's like, you know, she came to power as the wife. She has all this baggage. I wanted to be someone, but not her.
When she's running against, do you think there's a woman in the world, a 30-year-old woman in the world who is an avid Sanders supporter who forced to vote between Trump and Clinton? They might not
some
as enthusiastically.
Some of them are going to stay home. Yes.
Not that many are going to stay home. Some of them will stay home, but not that many.
Some of them will stay home.
No,
but that's in the spring fantasy land.
It's before the heart fluttering that you described takes hold.
No, it's right now. I mean, I don't look.
No, Sanders is still in the race. Sanders is still in the race. There's been no triumphant moment where Hillary Clinton, you know, does a heartfelt video about her grand triumphs at the convention and people come out and say like, yes, here we go. And she's running against a misogynist monster.
All I'm saying is, I think that, look, it's not like Elizabeth Warren is the only candidate out there. I do think, though, that she has some significant strengths. And I think that while it would, I mean, I said this a few weeks ago at Warren, it kind of worries me, the idea of two women on the ticket. It seems like too much at once for the country to swallow. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe I'm underselling the country. And maybe there are people who would come out, these, you know, these people who haven't voted before, who Sanders has appealed to so much, who will not necessarily just like show up at the polls for the Democrat because they're scared of Donald Trump and they need something more, and she would make the difference.
They're not going to show up at the polls because of the number two. They'll show up at the polls because the number one is saying things that continue to excite them and prove that she's believes in those issues. And then,
all right,
that,
so
you
who's your male pick for vice president?
I don't think
some white guy.
Anyone will.
I would be fine. John would be fine.
Boring ex-governor of Virginia.
I think just really any. I mean, no, that doesn't. Why they don't even have to have been a governor? Just a white guy.
Exactly.
Good.
I think making any claim for huge upside on vice presidential picks. Period. I'm very, very skeptical of. That's my main skepticism on Warren is it's not even about Warren. It's about the upside potential you get from any pick. I think the best possible picks are ones where they reinforce some quality of the underlying candidate.
Tough woman, underscoring tough woman qualities. Empathy,
yeah, John.
Caring.
Wait, empathy and caring are also tough women?
Yeah, yeah, tough, it's caring
the whole package.
Women. Yeah. I mean, what you just said would rule out like any vice president. I'm not arguing that, you know, Warren's going to send her shooting up in the polls. I'm not sure anyone would. But given that, why not Warren?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've been reading things that suggest there's all of this huge upside potential for it. Maybe I'm overreading the case people make for her. Also, by the way, if you look at the race that Hillary Clinton ran, I know people said she moved to the left, but only on trade. She basically didn't move there on minimum wage. She didn't move there on healthcare.
She did on minimum wage.
That's going to fool all those smart young women who care about policy that she like kind of wiggled over on minimum wage. I don't think that's going to get those people crashing through the door to go pound yard signs and organize for the ticket. On policy matters.
Well, good. Matters, I'm glad that you're thinking she should move even further to the left. Well, watching that happen.
Yeah. No, that's hardly the case. I just think I think that you can't pick a candidate. If you're not going to embrace the underlying ideas, I don't think you can pick a candidate and have people suddenly say, oh, you know, she's now suddenly embracing those underlying ideas.
All right, let's leave it there. We'll come back to this Veep question later. There is a terribly sad story out of California involving a young woman raped while unconscious by a Stanford freshman, I think, named Brock Turner, a white man.
Yes, he was 19 at the time.
Yeah, a white man and a star athlete at Stanford. Turner was found guilty by a jury of three felonies and sentenced by Judge Aaron Persky to only 6 months in prison, less, I believe, than the guidelines suggested. Persky was lenient on many grounds, that Turner was drunk, that he was unlikely to be violent again, had no history of violence, and most irritatingly to many people,
concerned about the impact on his future of sending him to prison.
Yeah, concerned about the impact on his future, and also he'd already suffered so much from the loss of his college scholarship. Attention really focused on this case when BuzzFeed published in full the statement that the victim had made in court, a statement that described her wounds, that described what had been taken from her, the violence that had been done to her, and her experience of it. Very remarkable document, a remarkable piece of self-examination.
Narrative, description, taking of power, pretty much everything. Yeah.
Turner's own statement to the court, and then a statement that was released, that was leaked, that his father had also made towards the court asking for leniency. Both those statements took very little responsibility for the crime, shrugged blame off on drinking culture, the generally promiscuous culture of college, and really complained about the effects this would have on Turner's life. And those statements were not welcomed by a lot of people in the world. It is very hard not to be enraged by what's going on.
What is the debate here?
There's the privilege that got him a lenient sentence. The question of what the proper sentence ought to have been. I mean,
yeah, that is interesting.
I actually think there's another discussion to have as well, which is that The sentence is, in my view, not defensible, especially the way at which it was arrived. Although I also just want to note that Brock Turner also has to register for life as a sex offender, which is like a real thing that comes along with the verdict, right? Okay, so that's like part. And also, he, you know, has been banned for life from Stanford. I think that was the right outcome for these facts. But here's a different way to view this case. Not only to look at the way in which the sentence is disappointing to this victim and a lot of her supporters, and our general feeling that the country is too tolerant of men who commit rape. There's also the fact that this was a drunken encounter in which the victim blacked out and couldn't remember what had happened. And often when you have those kinds of circumstances, we don't have any kind of holding of responsibility. I mean, this is a case in which, because to some degree of this sort of key other fact, the appearance of two witnesses, these two Stanford graduate students were bicycling by, they saw this woman not moving, and they saw Brock Turner on top of her behind a dumpster outside of a frat house on campus. And they stopped their bikes. They knew something was wrong. When Turner tried to run away, they chased him down and they called the police. And the police disbelieved Turner. He, you know, told them he thought that this woman was consenting, that yes, he'd been drinking and so had she, but he even said that he thought she was enjoying herself, which was just horrific, the victim said, when she realized he'd made that statement. But in any case, the police, the prosecutors, the university, everyone except for this judge saw this case through the eyes either of the victim or the eyes of these graduate students, who one of whom cried when he told the police what he'd seen. And that is actually like a sign of progress for people who want to reform rape law and who are worried about men getting away with all kinds of things when it comes to sexual assault. So like, let's just take into account that part of it too, because I think it matters.
Isn't this in some sense the flip side of Trump's case against Curiel, that here you have a judge who, because he was a white man, former Stanford athlete himself, he may have some intrinsic sympathy for the defendant, for Brock Turner, because of his race and position and interests, and rules in favor of him because of that. It's really like the same. It's the same issue.
Well, it did feel infuriatingly possible that that was the case. And,
wait, so if that's infuriatingly possible, why is Trump so wrong?
Well, because we don't know that to be true, and we also...
Yeah, but you're entertaining the idea. You're totally entertaining the idea, and you have a gut-level reaction to it that was...
Don't sound so pleased with yourself that Trump you caught me. No, come on. That's not fair. Look, I have been struggling... There's a recall campaign against this judge, and I've been struggling with what to make of that, in large part because I've been thinking about it through the Trump lens, right? If we assume that this person, you know, no longer deserves to be in office because maybe his decision was biased or just wrong, then Right. Well, maybe that's the better way to think about this. Maybe we shouldn't be making the connections, even in our heads, that David has made.
What you mean? So you say it's wrong, but you don't interrogate why it's wrong, why it might be wrong,
because they are
demographically and socioculturally matched.
Well,
the problem with go ahead.
You don't have to get there, do you? Can't you just say
no?
It's
but
wrong?
But how do you get to the solution? Which the solution is that we need we need judges who reflect. And the judges have to be aware of that themselves.
Yeah. That's good. Well, I mean, or could you get it the way you... Because then what does that world look like? Because then you have to, like, have the judges in the Donald Trump, Emily Bazelon world, you have to have the judges, like, meet some...
Test. Oh, great. I'm glad you've lumped me in with him. No, you don't. This is the answer to that. And it comes from Judge Posner, actually. It's that you have a judiciary that reflects the diversity of the country. And every judge brings what Judge Posner calls their priors with him or her to the bench, right? Everyone does their job in a way that's informed by their background, their child upbringing, their whatever, their education. That's just who we all are. But that doesn't mean we can't imagine that they're going to be fair and set those priors aside when we expect them to do their job. And so perhaps it's deeply unfair to Judge Persky to assume that he didn't do that here. It's just that it's tempting because of the shared pieces of identity.
Well, but can't you just have, make a bad decision and it not be about the pieces of shared identity? And isn't it...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a weird, bad decision, right? Like, here you have this guy gets charged with three serious felonies. He gets convicted by the jury. The standard that the jury is using is, did he know or reasonably should he have known that she didn't consent? And then at the sentencing, you start talking about, you know, how drinking makes him less morally culpable and you're worried about his future and you don't talk about her. Like, so, the reason David brought it up is like, why do you do that?
Yeah, but this is exactly what Trump said. It was such a weird, bad decision. This is the only thing I can
But he has no evidence of a weird, bad decision. He just has a bunch of rulings that have gone against
him. Yeah, well, in his case, that's what he believes. But the point is that the logic pattern and the thoughts are, you know, not totally dissimilar.
Right.
But isn't the answer that you teach that judges should rule based on, like, that he basically just overvalued these other things that is just, and that just is wrong on its face, regardless of what kind of a judge he was.
Right, and would be wrong no matter who he is.
Yeah, and so have judges be smarter in the way they weigh these kinds of cases.
Can we actually go to the question of whether this is a terrible sentence? I haven't done significant or any research, so what I'm about to say is Emily's about to tear apart and all of our listeners.
Keep going.
It seems to me that the problem here is not that this guy got 6 months and is a sex offender for life. It's that everybody else is getting outrageously long sentences. The only mechanism we can think of here is a longer and longer sentence and then a sex offender registry. It's not clear to me that putting anybody on a sex offender registry for life does any good to anybody at all. There's a lot of evidence that that is just a terrible thing that is ruinous for ex-offenders and doesn't actually make anything safer, number one. And number two is, should any 19-year-old at the start of their life, you know, for a terribly serious crime, is society served by putting that person away for 20 years generally?
I don't think 6 months and 20 years are the only choices here.
I'm not somebody who wants to recall judges for giving lighter sentences than general. Yeah, in general,
we're
over sentencing people. And if this makes us realize, like, you know what, the young Hispanic and African American kids who are convicted of sexual assault and are getting 10 times the sentence, that's the real problem, rather than this one kid is somewhat under sentenced.
Yeah, I would say two things. First of all, I don't think that the chances of this translating into leniency for men of color or poor men, I just, that seems like a fantasy to me.
True.
And the second thing is that 6 months for rape, that's too short. I agree with you in general that we send people to prison for too long, but relative to how we think about punishment, and also I just feel like objectively, that's just not enough prison time. And it bothers me immensely that the person who received that leniency is this privileged white guy and not someone who might have had a lot more reason to explain such terrible behavior.
Do you think it is wrong for Brock Turner's family to spend enormous resources and use their position of privilege to try to get him a lighter sentence? And was his father wrong to try to do everything he could to get him a lighter sentence?
No, I don't actually blame his parents for that. I mean, I think his father went about it in a really ham-handed way, and there's a self-centeredness to the statement he wrote that I understand it as a parent, but it was, first of all, in the court of public opinion, has been totally self-destructive. And also, it's just, there's a blindness there. I mean, talking about sexual promiscuity when your son has been found attacking an unconscious woman behind a dumpster, that has nothing to do with
right. There's like not enough. There's not enough promiscuity. If there was sexual promiscuity, you would find someone to have sex with that you didn't have to rape. That's what promiscuous culture means, right?
Yeah, I mean, this woman didn't do anything that we know of that suggests that. It's just that really just makes me want to take a shower. On the other hand, I do feel like parents make mistakes at moments like this because they're consumed with concern for their kids. And I do feel like the shaming machine on the internet is kind of out of control in this case, even though I agree with the underlying discomfort.
I too was struck, Emily, by the self-involvement of Turner's own statement and then his father's statement, that there's this such a tendency in people have such a hard time not focusing on themselves.
And just accepting responsibility in some really basic way.
I mean, it's the attempt, like they made Turner himself a victim of society, of circumstances, of drinking. And Turner's statement, more than his father's statement, I found so weak. Yeah. It was really just about himself and like how I don't want to go to any parties where there's any drinking anymore. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do it. And just so little ability to put himself in the place of the woman whose life he has destroyed and ruined and it's really...
Well, hopefully he hasn't destroyed and ruined her life. But yes, he certainly hurt her and wounded her. And there was... he must just be still fundamentally unable to accept that he committed this serious crime. There's just a way in which he was... Even though he expressed remorse, it felt like mostly he was excusing himself.
But I do think that's everyone's tendency. Everyone's tendency is just to think about... The people just want to make themselves into victims.
It's true, and it worked with the judge. It's just that it is not flying with the rest of us.
John, let's close on the victim statement. Victim statement, which BuzzFeed published, and CNN, a CNN anchor, Ashley Banfield, read in full on CNN. More power to her. Just an incredibly powerful piece of writing.
Yeah.
Is there anything that comes out of it, anything more significant than this is just a powerful piece of writing about a young woman who's had her life turned upside down?
Well, I think in addition to giving voice to somebody who feels like the system stole her voice and advantaged the voice of someone else based merely on the sports they play and the advantage of their birth and the school they went to, so there's a rebalancing that of what an injustice that she felt took place in the courtroom. I think then as a symbol for lots of other rape victims who feel the same way, or sexual assault victims who feel the same way about their voice, I think it also gave power to that silent and angry, justifiably obviously so, group. I think another way, though, is that it hopefully there will be men who will read this and who will – it will have some effect on them. I think that's the – those are three of the lasting benefits of it.
I also think there's an amazing way in which some – rape victims of late have just refused to be ashamed. They're speaking very frankly about what happened to them. They're making people see the experience through their eyes, and they're coming together. She ends on this amazing note of saying that she wants other girls and women in her position to know that she's there for them. And that is really powerful and has the capacity also to change how we think about this issue, because it doesn't have to simply be ruinous. I mean, I don't want to diminish that part of the experience because it's very present in this letter, but there's also the sense that this is a person who has an enormous amount to contribute, and she's going to make sure that happens.
And by the way, we should the other lesson that should is the two – were they Swedish? The two Swedish graduate students? That's the thing that's also should be kind of – should be held up, because I remember this in something that happened when I was in school. There was a lot of, you know, sort of like, oh – so it's just trying to move past it, literally, move past situations that should not stand. And so when people stop and do things like that, which in this case made all the difference, or maybe not, given the people's feelings about the sentencing, but there should be more people like that in the world.
And this is exactly what campus sexual assault prevention is trying to teach, is this idea of bystander intervention or being an upstander, that, you know, you should be on the lookout for an alert to situations in which you can help someone out.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. I got this pickle juice.
Just pickle juice?
A gin cocktail.
Oh, good. I'm glad there was
gin. It was gin and pickle juice and some lime juice and simple syrup. It was good.
Was this because you had pickle juice, or you're just like, you're now in some...
I had a pickle juice.
Was it like at the bottom of the jar? Did you buy pickle juice?
Some artisanal operation in D.C. convinced me to buy brine. I was like,
instead of putting salt in your own water?
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, I have some pickle. They've left. This is a pickling company. They have some leftover brine, and they've just sold it to me for $5. I am such a sucker.
But that's okay. And then you went back to painting your fence. Your neighbor's fence, I should say.
So what is your chatter, Emily?
I have been listening with great enjoyment to a podcast called Two Dope Queens. It's by Jessica Williams and Phoebe Robinson. They have all kinds of super fun comedians on. They talk about their lives in a refreshing, blunt, fun way. And I'm really enjoying it. And so I'm sure some of our listeners already know about it, but it's pretty new, right, David?
It is. It's a couple months old. It's great.
Yeah. So check it out. It's fun. Two Dope Queens, WNYC. You can find it wherever we are, wherever podcasts everywhere are.
John Dickerson, what is your chatter?
My chatter is thanks to Reddit, which I've been having a new or renewed love affair with recently. I don't know why. Because I've been finding great things on there. But also, I think it's because basically I put the app on my first screen. And anyway, this is about shot towers. So the reason I like this story is, so it all starts from a plumber named William Watts in 1783 in Bristol, in Bristol, England.
I love it when John says 1783.
It's like, what Watts did is
William Henry Harrison.
What Watts recognized, I guess, because he was in the company of so much water, being that he was a plumber, was that water, when raindrops fall, or we sort of often make them in the shape of a teardrop, like a kiss candy. But that's not the way they fall. When they fall, they're spherical. So Mr. Watts saw an opportunity in this. And at the time, shot for bullets for rifles were created in cavity molds. So you pour a bunch of lead into a mold and it didn't work. It was really hard to do. The balls that were produced were kind of cattywampus, so they didn't fly straight. They would hit sometimes. People used to get shot, and it would kind of like bounce off them because it had lost all of its velocity in flight. So Watts thought, oh, well, of course, we can make shot this way. But what I love about this is, so in order to figure out if he was right, he went home to his tenement house. And this basically, the reason it's spherical is it has to do with surface tension. Somebody maybe can write in and explain exactly why it works out that way. But he went back to his brick row house in Bristol and began adding floors to his house. He's just like out there like building new floors so that he can go all the way to the top and put a tank at the bottom and drop the shot. So turns out Mr. Watts, after building two new floors, and there's a picture. This is what attracted to me in the beginning was there's a picture of his row house in Bristol, and there's like all these row houses, and then there's this one that goes bloop, and it goes up two stories. It looks like a sort of a medieval turret. Anyway, so then after he knocked through all the floors and put a water tank at the bottom, he poured the lead into a sieve, and the lead formed into spheres that fell for six floors, and it dropped into the water below, and boom, it worked perfectly. So in America, they started doing this too. And so for a long time, the tallest buildings in America, and I think the one in the Phoenix Shot Tower in Baltimore was the tallest tower in the United States for about two decades. This is what these were. And the other cool thing about the Phoenix Tower, by the way, in Baltimore was that it's made completely of bricks. I think for a while it might have been the more bricks than in any other building or it was also built without any scaffolding, which is just a – but that this guy breaking through the ceiling of his house in Bristol, England, suddenly across the United States, there were all of these shot towers made to – or created to produce shots.
That's awesome.
That's what I learned.
I'm just sending this to my Atlas Obscura colleagues.
But I feel like Atlas Obscura has – you know, I feel like you must have done something.
We've done something with them. I'm just looking it up.
Oh, okay.
Do you have to do this right now?
Yeah.
Can't you actually be on the show and then send your note to your colleagues?
But now it's done. It's done. Oh, okay. That was journalism in action right there. My chatter is about a fantastic story. I'm surprised you didn't chatter this, Emily, in The New Yorker this week by our friend Amanda Schaefer.
Oh, I love the story. I'm so glad you're chattering that.
It's called Lost at Sea. And it is about an amazing episode in 1941, in the summer of 1941, when a U.S. ship called the Robin Moore, carrying equipment, it was a freighter, carrying equipment and a few passengers, I think it was sailing to South Africa, was accosted by a German submarine that sank it after allowing the passengers to get onto lifeboats. And it's a story about what happened to the passengers who were placed onto lifeboats, these three or four lifeboats, and set adrift in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And it's an an incredible story of the beginning of the war, of survival, of terror, and it has probably one of the best last page twists of anything you'll read this year. It's got a great
ending.
Finishing twist. Yeah, really, it's really got a great ending. So I would commend you to The New Yorker, Lost at Sea. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. The Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/Gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/Gabfest, and our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Please subscribe to the Gabfest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. If you like the show, that really helps us. Search for Slate Political Gabfest in the iTunes store. For Emily and John, I'm David. We will talk to you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.